Well, I love that children's story. A big response. But I noticed the women were clapping and the men were looking perplexed. So I thought I better leave it alone. Today I was going to share in the next three sermons thoughts about the light, being children of the light. And what does that mean, and is that something for us? And I thought about our religion as being a religion of love. And if love has a dynamic to it, a motion to it, a movement to it, then can it really be a religion? Is a question. We live out of love if we're a religion of love, and in a sense we work to being an expression of love, and I guess in a sense our being becomes love itself. Our consciousness moves from love, and all that we do moves from a sense of unity steeped in love and compassion. This is the outcome of a spiritual life that seeks to become a child of the light. And that's a decision that we have to make as human beings. Do we want to become children of the light? Or is that something for fairy tales or for myths, and it doesn't account for reality? Does it mean we have to believe in a God or choose a God, or is there some sense of divine? What does that mean? And I'll go back to that statement that we choose a God, and I want to say that indeed we do choose a God as human beings, and as we look, if we could float above the planet and go look around, we will see many different ideas about God, and people have chosen different views of God to live out different views of God. I mean, even in our country today, a lot of people would say that we're a Christian nation, but it does seem to me that we follow the God of Mars. I don't know how many of you all think about that, but there is certainly a lot of war in our history, which is more of an expression of a particular God than a God of love. So it gets confusing for those who choose God. But I was noticing the other night, evening, we were going to hear Helen's brother play bluegrass in Vera Beach with a group of fellows he plays with on Tuesday nights. And we were walking by a park, and Betty, Helen's mom, said, "Well, isn't that a lovely little girl playing in the park?" And her mom was over there watching her. And then we walked by, and then I noticed that the little girl fell, and she really didn't know what to do with the fall. You know how when little kids fall, they kind of look at the parent for whether they should be upset or not. We do, right? And so she was a little upset, and you'd see a little pout, and mom came over, and mom, and she wasn't, the little girl was distraught, but you know, which way should I go? And mom just touched the boo-boo. And that little girl smiled, and she was all better, and I thought, what is it about us human beings that's a pretty common experience? Well, if I had to choose a God, I would choose Mother, because that looked pretty good to me. I kind of like that. She was right there with her, knew what was going on. It wasn't a crisis, but knew that her touch would soothe. So maybe I would choose Mother as God. But I've noticed something else about people who choose particular gods and myths and stories. And I've come to a conclusion that may make sense or may not make sense. I'm trying to figure it out myself. And that there seems to be this notion of God as an energy is designed to hold a continuity of story or myth through time. It's the energy that holds the myth through time. Now, if that makes sense, at least yet, because if you talk to a person who believes in a God and has a story about their God, and you try to disrupt that story, you got a problem. That story is not going to get disrupted. That story is going to have continuity through time, and the religion is about sustaining that story through time without change. And usually what you find when people do change religions, beliefs, or myth, a crisis has occurred. I can remember in the Baptist church that there was a rule, no divorced people could teach Sunday school, or no divorced people could preach or be called to ministry, or if you got divorced, you proved yourself unworthy and you could no longer do that. Except then the preacher's daughter went through a divorce and that changed the whole thing, and divorced people could now participate in the church. Right? Lack of empathy, which we talked about last time I was here, a lack of empathy until it happened to him. Then empathy comes. But all those years of denying people participate, well, that's another whole thing. So, and then it does seem to me that priests have the high calling of making sure that story is sustained through time. And that making sure that story is represented as truth as it is maintained through time, and any threats to that story, the priest would say to the young Baptist child, don't go out with the Methodist child. Or that kind of craziness, because they're not of our story. That story cuts through time, among all other stories, but that story is the true story. And really, care and compassion for people outside of that story sometimes not a consideration. I remember reading several years ago, did a sermon on love and got out my dictionary of pastoral care and counseling, which I love. You know, pastoral counselors were all excited. We had our own dictionary, which means we had our own language, which means we really existed. That was a big step for pastoral counseling. Theory, but anyway, I looked up the word love, and there was one definition of Christian love, talking about the Roman Empire, and that Christian love was available for those within the empire. But those outside of the empire, they didn't get love. They got something else, the advancement of imperialism, so forth. But that love can be contained within a story, but if you're not in the boundaries of that story, watch out. Right? So that's a problem. So it's made up of truths. So we might say, well, what has that got to do? It sounds more like captivity than truth and light. Well, that is one kind of truth, as we learn from the Buddhist. And that's called conventional truth. Conventional truth is truth to your story. When I was in high school, this was absolutely true. Perry Hall wrestlers were better people than Kenwood wrestlers. Absolutely true. Conventional truth. And then when I went to the community college, and Kenwood wrestlers were on the community college wrestling team, they weren't so bad. You know, they were all right. So conventional truth begins to break down as our experiences begin to expand. Conventional truth begins to break down if we let it. In Chinese Buddhism, or in the 6th century, somebody asked the question, what is truth? What is truth? And so monks got together, and that's a big deal. We're going to have a big deal. It's what is truth? And they got their literature out, and their teachings out, and sacred text out, and they began to explore the meaning of truth. And just like Unitarians, they said, well, there's two kinds of truth. There's not one kind of truth. There's two kinds of truth, right? So if we're searching for truth and meaning, now we've got under truth, we've got A and we've got B. We've got two kinds of truth. And they decided that here's the two kinds of truth. Conventional truth, which I've just been talking about, truths that are localized to community, truths that are localized to geographical areas, or truths that are localized to people who have been converted or whatever, but they're more or less local truths that we would say are absolute truths. Then they said there's the ultimate truth. There's another truth. There's a truth that is beyond the conventional truths. There is a truth that has no form to it. There is a truth of just existing. There is a truth of nature, and we're part of nature, and it's true, but there are no words, there are no language in that experience. It's a pre-reflective experience. It's just experience itself. It's just being itself without language to give it form, give it shape, or without language to give it conventional truth. That's another kind of truth. And in that truth, we find the experience of light without darkness. So how do we move in between conventional truth and ultimate truth? I mean, how do we live? How do we live it? How do we become people who can live in ultimate truth? And in my experience, and when I read that, living in that place without the boundaries, without being confined and coerced by conventional truths, there is a sense of well-being there. There is a sense of love and compassion there. That somehow when we're in this ultimate truth, somehow when we're without belief systems, when we're without that kind of coerciveness, that there is a oneness and a unity and a movement toward kindness and compassion. And we see it in the teachings of Judas. We see it in the teachings of Jesus and in the teachings of Buddha. We see it in the religious, that there somehow is love and compassion. But as soon as I step into conventional truth, I create a dualism. I create something other than. So how do I live there? How do I live in that light? And how do I stay there? Have you ever had, Beltane, that holiday's coming up, May 1st? You're all going to have an assignment. You'll love this assignment. And it has to do with the pre-reflective experience. That's why I'm doing this at this point. Trace your history back. Okay, so I suspect I have some Irish in me. So trace my history back to the time in which I was part of a group of people that in early spring, we got, and this is idealizing, so paraphrased, it could be true or not true, but where we as a group of people got around the fire and danced all night long to make sure that our crops would come in good, to make sure things would work. And it's an anticipation process. But in that dancing and in that place that we dance around the fire, we lose ourselves. It's a pre-reflective experience. It's an experience of just being. It's an experience of just being part of nature. It's not really an anticipation that spring's coming. It's not really a faith that spring's coming, because you at 56, I know spring's coming. I'm still celebrating it, but I know it's coming. So it's not the anticipation. It kind of is, but it's just that I'm part of that movement of the earth that moves and spring shows up, and I'm part of the spring showing up. It's a pre-reflective experience. So that's your assignment. I'm not trying to convert you to paganism. that's what the Western Christian world called paganism, but maybe they were just people doing what came natural to them, and they didn't label themselves at all. Maybe somebody else gave them a label. Maybe they just were doing what they wanted. But how do we move from these conventional truths that are captive, that are trapping, that makes an us and a them, that makes we're going to do well? And I'm going to suggest that being a child of the light, the way I'm talking about it today, this is a risk, because it's a conviction, and whenever you give a conviction that turns into a belief, then you can take that belief and create a them and a us, because I have the belief and they don't, so then there's naturally a them and a us. So this is a risk. But I'm going to say this is a characteristic of a child of the light as we break conventional truths. And this characteristic is this, that when I read
history and travel through history to make decisions for how I'm going to be today, to make decisions for how I'm going to interact here, to make decisions how I'm going to vote, to make decisions whether I'm going to march or not, to make decisions what I'm going to say at a dinner table, that as I learn history, that I have the capacity to step into that history and see the events of history from all the perspectives with an attitude of compassion and love. That's what a child of light does. For example, and I'm going to do the very thing I think I'm saying we shouldn't do, but that'll be an example one way or another. For example, recently in Maine, in Labor Hall's department, the governmental building, there was a mural of labor history. And you see pictures of children in factories, I would guess, and 8 to 12-year-old children. You might even remember that 8 to 12-year-old children one time demonstrated a march and said, we only want to work a 50-hour week, if you might remember that. And the governor of Maine said, we're going to take that mural down because the history that it depicts, the history that it shows, seems to be in favor of labor and doesn't give a fair picture of companies, of business. Right. So he did. He took it down. Caused a big stir. Well, big enough that I heard about it, talking about it now. I'm going to suggest that the governor, and again, this is whenever you do a conviction and you have a belief, this is danger. I'm going to suggest the governor did not go back and read that history and step into the life of that 8-year-old child who was working in the garment factory and look out at the world with love and compassion. I'm going to say, yeah, he did not do that. Or to the women, or to the men in hard working conditions where they worked to get safe working conditions and they went on strike, many lost their lives and got good working conditions in some places. In some places. Because if he would have did that, he would say, I would think, and again, this is my prejudice. Again, I would say if he did that, he would say, no, we need to tell that history. We need to know that history, because if we don't know that history, maybe we'll fall prey into being oppressive again and thinking it's good, you know. It's good. So there's a danger in that. And then I can learn something about myself when I look at a story through history. Because the people that I identify with and the people that I look out with, look out through their eyes in the story, reveal something about me. Because if I do that with the 8-year-old, and I'm saying a child of the light is to do this with everybody involved in the story with a sense of love and compassion, I need to be able to do it for the CEO that made the decision to have the child labor as well. For me to fully understand that history the best that I can understand that history. Now, I am more able to float into, if you will, the child looking out and thinking, why can't I go play and fly a kite? I've got 10 hours in this factory. I can get there. I don't think that means you punished me, Mom, and kept me captive as a kid. I couldn't fly a kite. Why, that comes to me. But that's the image that comes to me, that this child's not free to go play. This child's captured for the benefit of somebody else. So I can get there. But I'll tell you, I have a hard time maintaining a sense of love and compassion and seeing from that CEO's eyes. I have a hard time doing that. But that's not about that. I mean, this is all in my head. It's about me. See, that's a place inside me that needs attention and needs work. For my spirituality. And if I'm going to move in the direction to say that I'm involved in a religious process that is a movement toward love and the expression of love, as I look at history and look at stories and find out which people I identify with and which people I don't, I need to attend to that area of my life. Why can't I, with an attitude of love, experience that person in my imagination? What's going on with me? I think it's because I know that when people make decisions,
that are hurtful to other people, that something has happened to that person. Something hurtful has happened to that person, that their empathy is not working, that there's a board of directors of their city. You remember the 1960s with the Pintos, and there was a decision that that they'd run into each other and they would blow up, and rather than fix it, that we're going to go ahead because it would cost more to fix it than it would cost to pay the people off, families off, the people who died. You know that story. You know, stuff like that's going on all the time. Something's had to happen to a person. Because for me to make that decision, that somebody would bring me that information, being a child of the light, here's what I would have to do. I'd have to say, okay, somebody's going to die. So I have to step into that person's life. What's the sense of love and compassion? What would that be like? To rob them of their family, to rob them of Christmas, whatever it is, their family. Then I have to step into their child's life, their partner's life, and everybody involved in that story. That's a slow process, number one, in this fast-paced culture. I have to stop my life in order to do that. And I have to do that all the way around, all the people involved, including the people that are working on the assembly lines and whatever that might mean for them, that I might have insight to all of it. And then come back and make that decision. And then come back and make that decision. So in order for me to have empathy and compassion and see from the eyes of the person who can make that decision, I have to experience their suffering somehow. I don't know how that works. But if I'm going to be a fully empathetic being, now if you remember in the New Testament, there's a part of the story, Jesus is walking along and then he separates himself and he goes up above Jerusalem and he just starts weeping. Just starts weeping. And I wonder if that's not got something to do with this. That somehow he's aware of the suffering of the people that are making the decisions in that city, and he weeps. And so when we talk about being a child of the light, or a person that wants to experience that we hear, and I was looking up children of light on the internet and messing around with that, and I want to tell you, it was all happy stuff. It was all good stuff, you know, and floating in the air, and I was trying to figure out how I could get a platform and a long white robe, a little longer hair, and kind of float in and be here and say, come to the light and you too can float. You know, those kind of things, because what it seems to be. But when we read through history and read people that claim and teach out of this light, what we find is periodically they go up on a hill and they look at a city and they weep. They weep. And if I want to move in that direction, as much as, yes, we want to have those experiences where we can be in the ultimate truth and all that might mean, and we won't know what that means until we do it, because this is a faith of practice, this is a religious of practice, it's not something we think, we have to actually do it. Being in that place of being at ease, and in a way detached, not in a negative way, but detached from the worries of the world, and be able to have that place in our life, yes, that's part of it. But there's another part of it. And the other part of it is we move into the world where we can see where people who have been injured because of the decisions that they are making and try to figure out a path of healing. Now, I tell you, it's much easier to do a path of protest, dissent, yelling, arguing. I'm not saying that's not needed. That's easier than the empathy and the healing. Because the empathy and the healing route means I've got to figure out some way to communicate, to talk to directly. Protesting means we get together and enjoy each other and hold up signs and say this is the right thing to do, and why aren't we doing it as a culture, which we need to do as well.
But if we're going to talk about this love,
and we're going to talk about light, and we're going to talk about living out of that light and living out of that ultimate truth, we also need to be available to experience the suffering of others and find places of healing and move in that direction to offer that healing and find those wounded places in ourselves. We have to practice that kind of meditative process of living in conventional truth and letting go of that, which next week we'll talk more about how to do that, and experiencing this ultimate truth and some practical ways to do that. But it's a decision to do that, and it's not just all light. Some of it's sharing with other people in suffering. That's a decision. And I'm inviting you to make that decision. And in the next sermon, we're going to talk about some very practical ways to navigate the waters between conventional truth, ultimate truth, and back and forth, and maintaining our sanity.